husband goes on inspection tours in summer. It is very good for his health and pleasant for him. And we have an arrangement by which this allowance goes for the hire of a carriage and coachman for me. On his way to the distant province, Karenin stopped 3 days in Moscow. On the day after his arrival, he went to call on the Governor-General. At the crossing of Gazetny Street, where there is always a crowd of carriages and izvozchiks, he suddenly heard someone calling out his name, in such a loud and cheerful voice that he could not help looking round. On the pavement at the corner of the street, in a short, fashionable overcoat and a small, fashionable hat, his teeth gleaming between his smiling red lips, young, gay and beaming, stood Oblonsky, determinedly and insistently shouting and demanding that Karenin should stop. He was holding with one hand the window of a carriage, from which the head of a lady in a velvet bonnet and two little children's heads were leaning out, and was smilingly beckoning with his other hand to his brother-in-law. The lady, too, with a kind smile, waved her hand to Karenin. The lady with the children was Dolly. Karenin did not wish to see anyone in Moscow, and certainly not his wife's brother. He raised his hat and was going on, but Oblonsky told the coachman to stop and ran across the snow.
"What a shame not to have sent word! Been here long? And I went to Deduzho's hotel yesterday and saw Karenin on the board, and it never entered my head that it could be you," said Oblonsky, thrusting his head in at the carriage window. "Else I should have looked you up. I am glad to see you."
And he kicked his feet together to knock off the snow.
What a shame not to send word!
I could not find time. I am very busy, Karenin answered dryly.
Come and speak to my wife. She is so anxious to see you.
Karenin unfolded the rug he had wrapped round his legs, which were so sensitive to the cold, got out of the carriage, and making his way through the snow, approached Dolly.
What is the matter, Alexei Alexandrovich? Why do you avoid us in this way?
Dolly smilingly asked.
I was exceedingly busy. Very pleased to see you, he said in a tone that expressed clearly that he was very sorry. How are you?
And how is my dear Anna?
Karenin muttered something and was about to go when Oblonsky stopped him.
Do you know what we'll do tomorrow? Dolly, ask him to come and dine with us. We shall invite Koznishev and Pestsov so as to let him taste the Moscow intellectuals.
Yes, do come, said Dolly. We shall expect you at 5 or 6, just as you like. But how is my dear Anna? It is so long.
She is well, replied Karenin, frowning. I shall be very pleased. And he went back to his carriage.
Then you will come, cried Dolly.
Karenin muttered something which Dolly could not catch amid the noise of passing vehicles.
I shall call tomorrow, shouted Oblonsky to him.
Karenin got into his carriage and sat far back, so as neither to see nor to be seen.
Queer chap, said Oblonsky to his wife,
and after glancing at his watch, waved his hand in front of his face as a sign of endearment to his wife and children, and walked jauntily away along the pavement.
Stiva! Stiva!
Dolly called and blushed. He turned round.
You know that I must buy coats for Grisha and Tanya. Give me some money.
Oh, never mind. Tell them I will pay.
And nodding his head to an acquaintance who was driving past, he disappeared round the corner. Chapter 7. The next day was Sunday. Oblonsky went to the rehearsal of a ballet at the Imperial Theatre and gave to Masha Chibisova, a pretty dancer who, through his patronage, had just obtained an engagement, a coral necklace he had promised her the evening before, and behind the scene, in the midday darkness of the theatre, contrived to kiss her pretty face, which was brightened by his present. Besides giving her the necklace, he wished to make an appointment to meet her after the ballet. Having explained that he could not be there at the beginning of the performance, he promised to come for the last act and take her to supper. From the theatre, Oblonsky went to the market and himself selected the fish and asparagus for dinner, and at noon he was already at Duso's hotel, where he had to call on 3 people who, fortunately for him, had all put up at the same place.
These were Lievin, who had only just returned from abroad, a newly appointed superior official who was making a tour of inspection in Moscow, and Karenin, his brother-in-law, whom he wanted to secure for dinner. Oblonsky liked a good dinner, but liked still more giving a dinner party. Not a big affair, but one select in food, drink, and guests. With the programme for that day's dinner, he was very satisfied. There would be perch, brought alive to the kitchen, and asparagus. The pièce de résistance was to consist of a splendid but quite plain joint of roast beef, and the wines would be well chosen. So much for the food and drink. As for the guests, there would be Kitty and Lievin, and, in order that they should not be too conspicuous, a girl cousin and young Shcherbatsky. Here, the pièce de résistance was to consist of Sergei Ivanich Koznishev and Alexei Alexandrovich Karenin. Sergei Ivanich, a Muscovite and a philosopher, and Alexei Alexandrovich, a Petersburger and a practical politician. Besides these, he meant to ask the well-known crank and enthusiast Pestsov, a liberal and a great talker, a musician and historian, and the dearest of 50-year-old boys, who would serve as sauce or condiment to Koznishev and Karenin, while he himself, Oblonsky, would stir them all up and set them by the ears. The second installment of the forest money had been paid and was not yet all spent. Dolly had been very nice and kind of late, and the thought of his dinner party pleased Oblonsky in every respect. He was in very high spirits. Just two circumstances were not quite satisfactory, but they were drowned in the ocean of kind-hearted joviality which overflowed his heart. These two circumstances were as follows. From the fact that when he had met Karenin in the street the previous day, the latter had treated him with cold stiffness and had not called or even informed them of his arrival, from this, added to the rumour about Anna and Vronsky that had reached him, Oblonsky concluded that all was not as it should be between the husband and wife. This was one of the unpleasant things, while the other was the fact that his new superior, like all new superiors, had the reputation of being a dreadful man who got up at 6 in the morning, worked like a horse, and expected his subordinates to do the same. This superior also had the reputation of having the manners of a bear, and he was reported to hold views diametrically opposed to those of his predecessor, and, till now, of Oblonsky also. On the previous day, Oblonsky had appeared on service business in uniform. The new superior was very pleasant and chatted with him as with an old acquaintance. Therefore, Oblonsky now considered it his duty to call on him in a morning coat. The thought that the new superior might not take this in good part was the second unpleasant circumstance, but Oblonsky felt instinctively that everything would turn out splendidly. "After all, they're all human beings, all men, just like us poor sinners," he thought as he entered the hotel. "What is there to be angry and quarrel about?" Walking down the corridor, with his hat tilted on one side, he said, "How d'you do, Vasily?" to a servant he knew. "You've grown whiskers. Lievin, number 7, eh? Will you show me the way? And please find out whether Count Anichkin, the new superior, will receive me." "Yes, sir," replied Vasily with a smile. "It's a long time since you've been here." "I was here yesterday, but came by the other entrance. Is this number 7? Lievin was standing in the middle of the room beside a peasant from Tver, measuring a fresh bearskin with a yard measure, when Oblonsky entered.
"Ah! Killed it?" cried Oblonsky. "Fine thing! A she-bear! How do you do, Arkhip?"
He shook hands with the peasant and sat down without taking off his overcoat or hat.
"Do take your things off and stay," said Lievin, removing the hat.
"No, I have no time. I've only come in for a moment," replied Oblonsky, throwing open his coat.
Later on, he took it off and stayed for an hour, talking to Lievin about bear hunting and also about personal matters.
"Now, please tell me what you did abroad and where you've been," said Oblonsky when the peasant had left.
"Well, I stayed in Germany, in Prussia, in France, and in England. Not in the capitals, but in manufacturing centres. I've seen many new things, and I'm glad I went." "Yes, I know your idea of settling the working-class problem." Not at all. In Russia, there cannot be a working-class problem. In Russia, the question turns on the relation between the labourers and the land. They have the same problems there, but with them it is a case of patching up what has already been spoiled. While here...
Oblonsky listened to Lievin with attention.
"Yes, yes," he said. "Very likely you're right. But I'm glad you're in good spirits and go bear-hunting and work and are full of enthusiasms, because Shcherbatsky told me he met you and you were down in a mouth and kept talking about death."
"Well, what of that? I never stop thinking of death," said Lievin. "It really is time for me to die. All those things are mere nonsense. I will tell you frankly, I value my idea and my work immensely, but really... just think. This whole world of ours is only a speck of mildew sprung up on a tiny planet. Yet we think we can have something great. Thoughts, actions. They are all but grains of sand."
"But, my dear fellow, all that is as old as the hills."
"It is old. But, you know, when you have once grasped it clearly, everything becomes... so insignificant. If you once realize that tomorrow, if not today, you will die and nothing will be left of you, everything becomes insignificant. I consider my ideas very important, yet they too turn out to be insignificant, and would be even if it were as possible to carry them out as it was to surround this bear. And so one passes one's life, finding distraction in hunting or in work, merely not to think of death."
Oblonsky listened to Lievin with an affectionate and subtle smile.
"Well, of course. So now you've come round to my notion. Do you remember how you used to fly at me for seeking enjoyment in life? Do not be so severe, O moralist."
"But, of course, the good in life is..." Lievin became confused.
"Oh, I don't know. All I know is that we shall all die soon."
"Why soon? And you know, life has less charm when one thinks of death, but it is more peaceful."
"On the contrary, it is even brighter toward the end."
"However, I must be going," returned Oblonsky, rising for the 10th time.
"Don't go yet," said Lievin, trying to detain him.
"When shall we meet again? I'm leaving tomorrow."
"Yeah, well, I'm a good one. Why, I came on purpose. You must come and dine with us today. Your brother is coming, and my brother-in-law, Karenin."
"Is he here?" asked Lievin, and was going to inquire about Kitty. He had heard that she went to Petersburg at the beginning of the winter to visit her sister, who had married a diplomatist. He did not know whether she had returned, but changed his mind and thought, "Whether she comes or not will make no difference."
"Then you will come?"
"Yes, of course."
"Well, then, at 5, and in morning dress." And Oblonsky got up and went downstairs to call on the new superior. His instinct had not deceived him. The dreadful new superior turned out to be a most affable man. Oblonsky had lunch with him and sat talking so long that it was going on for 4 when he arrived at Karenin's.
Chapter 8. Karenin, after returning from church, spent the rest of the morning in the hotel. That day he had 2 matters to see to interview a deputation from a subject race which was in Moscow at that time and give them instructions, and to write to the lawyer as he had promised. The interview, though the deputation had been summoned on his initiative, was an affair that presented many difficulties and even dangers, and Karenin was very glad that it chanced to be in Moscow when he was there. The members of the deputation had not the least comprehension of their role or of their duties. They were naively convinced that their business consisted in explaining their needs and the existing state of affairs, and of asking for help from the government. They could decidedly not understand that some of their statements and demands would play into the hands of the hostile party and thereby ruin their case. Karenin had a prolonged tussle with them, and wrote out for them a program which they were not to overstep, and having dismissed them, he wrote two letters to Petersburg. One of them contained instructions regarding this deputation. In this matter, his chief helper was the Countess Lydia Ivanovna, who was a specialist in deputations. No one else could so well pilot a deputation or give it a good start. When he had finished with the deputation, Karenin wrote to the lawyer, without the least hesitation, giving him permission to act at his own discretion, and enclosing three notes from Vronsky to Anna, which he had found in the writing case he had taken possession of. Having left his home with the intention of never returning to his family, and having seen the lawyer and communicated, though only to that one person, this intention, and particularly after converting this matter of life into an affair of ink and paper, Karenin had grown more and more used to the notion, so that carrying it into effect now seemed to him possible. He was just closing his letter to the lawyer when he heard Oblonsky's voice. Oblonsky was disputing with Karenin's servant and insisting that he should be announced. "No matter," thought Karenin. "It is even better so. I will tell him about my position with regard to his sister at once, and will explain why I cannot dine at his house."
"Ask the gentleman in," he said in a loud voice, collecting his papers and placing them inside a blotter. "There, you see, you were lying to me. He is at home," came the voice of Oblonsky in answer to the man who had been trying to stop him as he entered the room, taking off his overcoat as he came. "I'm awfully glad I've found you in." "Well, I hope," began Oblonsky cheerfully.
"I can't come,"
Karenin, who was standing, said coldly, without offering his visitor a seat. Karenin had expected to enter at once upon the cool relation in which he would henceforth stand toward the brother of the wife against whom he was beginning divorce proceedings, but he had not counted upon the flood of kindliness which overflowed the banks of Oblonsky's soul. Oblonsky opened his clear and shining eyes wide.
"Why can't you? What do you mean?" he demanded in French, quite taken aback. "Oh, no, you have promised, and we are reckoning on you."
"I must tell you that I can't come because the family connection hitherto subsisting between us must now be severed."
"What? I mean, how? Why?" said Oblonsky, smiling.
"Because I am about to take proceedings to divorce your sister, my wife. I was obliged to..." But before Karenin could finish what he was about to say, Oblonsky did something quite unexpected. He uttered an exclamation of dismay and sat down in an easy chair.
"Dear me! Alexei Alexandrovich! What are you talking about?" he cried, a look of pain appearing on his face.
"It is true."
"Oh, forgive me, but I can't believe it."
Karenin sat down, conscious that his words had not the effect he had anticipated, that he would be obliged to give an explanation, and that whatever that explanation might be, it would not alter his relation to his brother-in-law.
"Yes, I am under the painful necessity of applying for a divorce," he continued.
"I will tell you just one thing, Alexei Alexandrovich. I know you to be a first-rate and a just man. I know Anna to be, excuse me, I cannot change my opinion of her, a fine, a splendid woman. And therefore, forgive me, but I cannot believe this. There must be some misunderstanding," said Oblonsky.
"Ah, if it were only a misunderstanding."
"Wait a moment."
"I understand," Oblonsky interrupted him.
"But of course."
"Only this. One should not be in a hurry."
"No, one shouldn't be in a hurry."
"I was not in a hurry," replied Karenin coldly. "In a case like this, it was impossible to consult anyone. I have quite made up my mind."
"But it is awful," said Oblonsky, sighing deeply.
"One thing I would do, Alexei Alexandrovich, if I were you.
I entreat you to do it."
"You have not yet commenced proceedings, as I understand."
"Well, before doing so, see my wife and talk it over with her.
She cares for Anna as for a sister. She is fond of you, and she is a wonderful woman. For heaven's sake, talk it over with her. Do me this favour, I entreat you.
Karenin considered, and for a while Oblonsky gazed at him, full of sympathy, without breaking the silence.
You will come and see her?
I hardly know. The reason I did not call on you is that I think our relationship must be altered.
Why? I don't see it. Allow me to believe that beside our family relationship, you share at least to some extent the friendly feeling I have always had for you, and sincere respect, added Oblonsky, pressing the other's hand. Even if your worst suspicions proved correct, I never took upon myself, and never will, to judge either side. And I see no reason why our relations should change. But do, now do come and see my wife.
Ah, we look at the matter differently, said Karenin coldly. However, don't let us talk about it.
But why won't you come? Supposing you came to dinner today. My wife expects you. Do come, and above all, do talk it over with her. She is a wonderful woman. For heaven's sake, I implore you on my bended knees.
If you wish it so much, I will come, said Karenin with a sigh. And anxious to change the subject, he inquired about a matter interesting them both. Oblonsky's new superior, a man who, though still young, had suddenly been given so important a post. Karenin had never liked Count Anichkin. Their opinions had always been at variance, and now he could not repress a feeling of spite quite comprehensible to anyone in an official position toward a more successful man.
Well, and have you seen him? Said Karenin with a venomous smile. Oh, yes, he came to the council yesterday. He seems to know his business perfectly and is very active.
Yes, but in what direction? Asked Karenin. Toward getting things done or toward changing what has been done already? The curse of our state is its red tape administration, of which he is a worthy representative.
I really don't know what his tendencies are, but I do know that he's a first-rate fellow, replied Oblonsky. I've just been to see him, and he really is a first-rate chap. We had lunch, and I showed him how to make that stuff, you know, wine with oranges. It's very refreshing, and it is amazing that he did not know of it. He liked it very much. Yes, he certainly is a first-rate chap.
Oblonsky looked at his watch.
Dear me, it is getting on for 5, and I have still to call on Dolgovushin. Well, then, do please come to dinner. You have no idea how grieved I and my wife will be if you don't.
Karenin parted from his brother-in-law in a very different manner to that in which he had met him.
"I have promised, and I will come," he answered in a dejected tone. "Believe me, I appreciate it, and hope that you will not repent it," Oblonsky replied, smiling.
As he put on his overcoat while walking away, his arm struck the servant's head. He laughed and went out.
5 o'clock, and morning dress, if you please,
he sang out, returning to the door. Chapter 9. It was past 5, and some of the visitors had already arrived when the master of the house came home. He entered together with Sergei Ivanich Koznishev and Pestsov, who had met on the doorstep. These two were the chief representatives of the Moscow intellectuals, as Oblonsky called them. Both were men respected for their characters and abilities. They respected one another, but in almost everything they were completely and hopelessly at variance, not because they belonged to different schools of thought, but just because they belonged to one camp. Their enemies confused them one with the other, and in that camp each of them had his own shade. And as there is nothing less amenable to agreement than disagreement on semi-abstract themes, they not only disagreed in their opinions, but had long been accustomed without anger to ridicule each other's incorrigible delusions. They were entering when Oblonsky overtook them, and were talking about the weather. Prince Alexander Dmitrich Shcherbatsky and young Shcherbatsky, Turovtsin, Kitty, and Karenin, were already in the drawing-room. Oblonsky noticed at once that without him things were going badly in the drawing-room. His wife, in her gala dress, a grey silk, evidently worried both about the children who would have to dine alone in the nursery and about her husband who had not returned, had not managed in his absence to mix the guests properly. They all sat like a parish priest's wife visiting, as the old Prince Shcherbatsky expressed it, evidently puzzled as to why they were all assembled there, and forcing out words in order not to remain silent. The good-natured Turovtsin clearly felt quite out of it, and the smile on his thick lips with which he met Oblonsky said as clearly as words, "Well, my friend, you have planted me among the clever ones. To have a drink at the Chateau des Fleurs would be more in my line." The old prince sat silent, his shining eyes looking askance at Karenin, and Oblonsky saw that he had already prepared some remark wherewith to polish off that dignitary of state whom people were invited to as to a dish of sturgeon. Kitty kept looking toward the door, gathering courage not to blush when Konstantin Levin should enter. Young Shcherbatsky, who had not been introduced to Karenin, tried to look as if this did not make him feel at all awkward. Karenin himself, as the Petersburg way is when one dines with ladies, was in evening dress with a white tie, and Oblonsky saw by his face that he had come only to keep his promise, and by being in that company was fulfilling an unpleasant duty. He was the chief cause of the iciness which had frozen all the visitors till Oblonsky's arrival. On entering the drawing-room, Oblonsky made his excuses, explaining that he had been kept by the particular prince who was his usual scapegoat whenever he was late or absent, and in a moment he had reintroduced everybody, and having brought Karenin and Koznishev together, he started them off on the subject of the Russification of Poland, and they immediately caught on, Pestsov joining them. Having patted Turovtsin on the shoulder, he whispered something funny in his ear and got him to sit down next to Dolly and the old prince. Then he told Kitty that she was looking very nice and introduced young Shcherbatsky to Karenin. In a moment he had kneaded all that society dough in such a way that the drawing-room was in first-rate form and was filled with animated voices. Only Konstantin Levin had not arrived. However, that was all for the best, for Oblonsky, on looking in at the dining-room, saw to his horror that the port wine and sherry were from Desprez and not from Levay, and having given orders to send the coachman as quickly as possible to Levay, he turned to go back to the drawing-room. But he met Levin at the door. "I'm not late."
"As if you could ever help being late," said Oblonsky, taking his hand.
"Are there many people here?"
"Whom have you got?"
asked Levin with a blush, knocking the snow off his cap with his glove.
"All our own people. Oh, Kitty is here. Come, I will introduce you to Karenin."
Oblonsky, in spite of being liberal, knew that to be acquainted with Karenin could not but be an honour, and therefore treated his best friends to that honour. But at that moment Konstantin Levin was not in a state fully to appreciate the pleasure of such an acquaintance. He had not seen Kitty since the memorable evening when he had met Vronsky, excepting for that one moment when he had caught sight of her on the high road. In the depths of his soul he had felt sure that he should meet her that evening, but to maintain his freedom of thought he had tried to assure himself that he did not know it. Now, when he heard that she was here, he was suddenly filled with such joy and at the same time with such fear that it took away his breath and he could not utter what he wished to say. What was she like? The same as before? Or as she was that morning in the carriage? What if Darya Alexandrovna had spoken the truth? Why should it not be true? He thought.
"Oh, do introduce me to Karenin," he brought out with difficulty. And with despairing determination he entered the drawing-room and saw her.
She was not as she had been before, nor as he had seen her in the carriage. She was quite different. She was frightened, shy, shamefaced, and therefore even more charming. She saw him as soon as he entered. She had been waiting for him. She was filled with joy, and that joy made her feel so confused that for a moment when, as he was approaching the hostess, he again glanced at her, Kitty herself, he and Dolly, all thought she would not be able to control herself, but would burst into tears. She blushed again, and quite rigid, with only her lips quivering slightly, sat waiting for him. He came up, bowed, and silently held out his hand. Had it not been for the light quivering of her lips and the moisture that made her eyes brighter, her smile would have appeared almost calm when she said, "What a long time it is since we saw one another," while with a desperate resolve her cold hand pressed his. "You have not seen me, but I saw you," said Lievin with a beaming smile of joy. "I saw you on your way to Ergoshevo from the station."
"When?"
she asked him with surprise. "You were driving to Ergoshevo," said Lievin, feeling that the happiness with which his heart was overflowing was taking his breath away. How did I dare to connect anything that was not innocent with this pathetic being? "Yes, what Darya Alexandrovna told me seems to be true," he thought. Oblonsky took his arm and led him up to Karenin. "Let me introduce you," and he gave their names. "Very pleased to meet you again," said Karenin, coldly, as he shook hands with Lievin.
"Are you acquainted?"
asked Oblonsky with surprise. "We spent 3 hours together in a railway carriage," said Lievin with a smile. "But we parted filled with curiosity, as people do after a masquerade. At any rate, I did."
"Dear me, if you please," said Oblonsky, motioning them toward the dining room.
The men went to the side table in the dining room, on which stood bottles with 6 kinds of vodka, and plates with as many sorts of cheese, with and without silver cheese knives, caviar, herrings, different kinds of tinned delicacies, and slices of French rolls. They stood round the scented vodka and the delicacies, and the conversation about the Russification of Poland between Koznishev, Karenin, and Pestsov gradually slackened in the expectation of dinner. Koznishev, who knew better than anyone how at the end of a most abstract and serious dispute unexpectedly to administer a grain of Attic salt and thereby to change his interlocutor's frame of mind, did so now. Karenin was arguing that the Russification of Poland could only be accomplished by high principles which the Russian administration must introduce. Pestsov insisted that one nation can assimilate another only when the former is more densely populated. Koznishev agreed with both, but with limitations. When they had left the drawing room, Koznishev, to finish the conversation, remarked with a smile, "Consequently, for the Russification of the alien nationalities, there is but one means, to breed as many children as possible. So my brother and I are acting worst of all, and you married gentlemen, and especially Stepan Arkadyevich, are acting most patriotically." "How many have you got?" he asked, turning to the host with a kindly smile and holding out a tiny wine glass to be filled. Everybody laughed, and Oblonsky most merrily of all.
"Yes, that is the very best way," he said,
chewing some cheese and filling the glass with a special kind of vodka. And the conversation was really ended by the joke.
"This cheese is not bad. May I help you to some?" asked the host.
"Have you really been doing gymnastics again?" he went on, turning to Lievin, and with his left hand he felt Lievin's muscles. Lievin smiled, tightening his arm, and under Oblonsky's fingers a lump like a Dutch cheese and hard as steel bulged out beneath the fine cloth of Lievin's coat.
"Here's a biceps, a real Samson."
"I expect great strength is needed for bear hunting," said Karenin, who had the vaguest notions about sport, as he helped himself to cheese and broke his slice of bread cut as fine as a cobweb. Lievin smiled.
"None at all. On the contrary, a child can kill a bear," he said, making room with a slight bow for the ladies who were coming up to the side table with the hostess.
"You have killed a bear, I hear,"
said Kitty, vainly trying to catch a wayward, slippery, pickled mushroom with her fork, and so shaking the lace of her sleeve through which her arm gleamed white.
"Have you any bears near your estate?"
she added, turning her lovely little head toward him and smiling. There was, it would seem, nothing unusual in what she had said. But for him, what a meaning there was, inexpressible in words, in every sound and every movement of her lips, her eyes, and her hands as she said it. There was a prayer for forgiveness and trust in him, and a caress, a tender, timid caress, and a promise, and hope, and love for him in which he could not but believe and which suffocated him with joy. No, we went to the Tver province. On my return journey, I met your brother-in-law, or rather, your brother-in-law's brother-in-law, on the train, he said, smiling. It was a funny meeting. And gaily and amusingly, he told how, after not sleeping all night, he, in his sheepskin coat, had rushed into Karenin's compartment. The guard, regardless of the proverb, judged me by my clothes and wished to turn me out, but I began to use long words, and you too, he went on, turning to Karenin, whose Christian name and patronymic he had forgotten. Judging me by my peasant coat, were going to turn me out, but afterwards you took my part, for which I am very grateful. The rights of passengers to a choice of seats are very ill-defined, said Karenin, wiping the tips of his fingers on his handkerchief. I noticed that you were not quite sure what to make of me, said Lievin, with a good-natured smile. So I hastened to start an intellectual conversation to expiate my sheepskin. Koznishev, while continuing his conversation with the hostess, listened with one ear to his brother, turning his eyes toward him, and thought, what has happened to him today? He behaves like a conqueror. He did not know that Lievin felt as if he had grown a pair of wings. Lievin knew that she was listening to his words and liked hearing him, and that was the only thing he cared about. Not only in that room, but in the whole world, there existed for him nothing but Kitty and himself, and he had now acquired a great significance and importance. He felt himself at a height that made him giddy, and there, somewhere far below, were all these good, excellent Karenins, Oblonskys, and the rest of the world. Quite casually, without looking at them, and just as if there was no other place to put them, Oblonsky placed Lievin and Kitty side by side. Well, you might sit here, he said to Lievin. The dinner was as good as the dinner service, a thing of which Oblonsky was a connoisseur. The soup, Marie-Louise, had succeeded to perfection. The tiny pasties melted in one's mouth and were flawless. Two footmen and Matvey, wearing white ties, manipulated the food and the wines unostentatiously, quietly, and quickly. The dinner was a success on the material side, and no less so on the non-material side. The conversation, sometimes general and sometimes tête-à-tête, never ceased, and toward the end became so animated that the men left the table without ceasing to talk, and even Karenin was infected. Chapter 10. Pestsov liked to bring his discussions to a finish, and had not been satisfied with Koznishev's remark, especially as he felt the fallacy of his own opinion.
I did not mean, he began over his soup, addressing Karenin, the density of population alone, but that combined with firm foundations. It is not principles that count.
It seems to me, replied Karenin, deliberately and languidly, that it is one and the same thing. In my opinion, only that nation which is more highly developed can influence another. Only that—
But the question is, interrupted Pestsov in his deep voice. He was always in a hurry to speak, and always seemed to stake his whole soul on what he was talking about. What does higher development consist of? The English, the French, or the Germans? Which of them is more highly developed? Which will nationalize the other? We see that the Rhine has become Frenchified, yet the Germans do not stand on a lower level, he shouted. There is some other law.
I think that the influence will always be on the side of the truly educated, said Karenin, slightly raising his eyebrows.
But what should we consider to be the signs of true education? Said Pestsov.
I fancy that those signs are well known, replied Karenin.
Are they fully known? Intervened Koznishev with a subtle smile. At present, a purely classical education is regarded as the only real education, but we hear lively discussions from both sides and cannot deny that the opposite view has many arguments in its favour.
You are a classic, Sergei Ivanich. Have a glass of claret, said Oblonsky.
I am not expressing my opinion of either kind of education, replied Koznishev, smiling at him condescendingly as at a child and holding out his glass. All I say is that both sides have weighty arguments in their favour, he continued, addressing himself to Karenin. I have had a classical education, but can personally find no place in that controversy. I see no clear proofs that a classical education should be preferred to a modern education.
Natural science has just as great an educational and mind-developing influence, Pestsov joined in. Take astronomy, or take botany, or zoology with its system of general laws.
I can't quite agree with you, answered Karenin. It seems to me that we must admit that the process of studying the forms of a language has in itself a beneficial effect on spiritual development. Besides, it is impossible to deny that the influence of the classics is in the highest degree a moral one, whereas, unfortunately, with instruction in natural science are connected those dangerous and false teachings which are the bane of the present times. Koznishev was going to say something, but Pestsov's deep bass interrupted him. He began with great warmth to prove the falseness of this opinion. Koznishev quietly waited to put in his word, evidently ready with a triumphant retort.
But one cannot help admitting, he said, with his subtle smile, turning to Karenin, one cannot help admitting that it is difficult to weigh exactly all the pros and cons of the different studies, and that the question which kind of education should be preferred would not have been so easily decided had there not been on the side of classical education that advantage which you have just mentioned. The moral advantage, disons le mot, the anti-nihilistic influence.
Exactly.
Were it not for the advantage of this anti-nihilistic influence on the side of classical education, we should have considered the question longer and should have weighed the arguments on both sides, said Koznishev, subtly smiling. We should have given a free field to both systems. But now we know that those classical education pills contain the salutary virtue of anti-nihilism, and we offer them boldly to our patients.
But supposing it has not that salutary virtue after all, he concluded, adding the grain of Attic salt.
Everybody laughed at Koznishev's pills, and Turovtsin, who had at last heard the something funny for which he had been waiting as he listened to the conversation, laughed particularly loudly and merrily. Oblonsky had made no mistake in inviting Pestsov. With Pestsov there, intellectual conversation could not stop for a moment. Hardly had Koznishev with his joke put an end to the discussion of one question before Pestsov immediately raised another.
One cannot even admit that the government had that aim in view, he said. The government is evidently guided by general considerations and is indifferent to the influence its measures may have. For instance, it ought to consider the education of women injurious, yet it established courses of lectures and universities for women.
And the conversation at once veered to a new subject, the education of women.
Karenin expressed the view that the higher education of women is generally confounded with the question of women's emancipation, and that was the only reason for considering it injurious.
I, on the contrary, think that these two questions are firmly bound together, said Pestsov. It is a vicious circle. Women are deprived of rights because of their lack of education, and their lack of education results from their lack of rights. We must not forget that the subjection of women is so widespread and so old that we often refuse to recognize the abyss that separates them from us.
You said rights, remarked Koznishev, who had been waiting for Pestsov to stop. The right of serving on a jury, on town councils, of being presidents of local government boards, civil servants, members of parliament,
undoubtedly.
But if women, in some rare exceptional cases, can fill these posts, it seems to me that you should not speak of rights. It would be more correct to say duties. Everybody will agree that when we fill the office of juryman, town councillor, or telegraph clerk, we feel that we are fulfilling a duty.
So it would be more correct to say that women are seeking for duties, and quite rightly. And we must sympathize with this desire of others to help in man's work for the community.
You are quite right, said Karenin. I think the only question is whether they are capable of fulfilling these duties.
In all probability, they will be extremely capable, interjected Oblonsky, when education is more widely diffused among them. We see this.
And how about the old proverb? Remarked the old prince, who had long been listening to the conversation with a humorous twinkle in his small, glittering eyes.
My daughters won't mind my mentioning it. Women's hair is long, but their wits... They thought the same of the Negroes before their emancipation, said Pestsov angrily.
The thing that seems strange to me is that women should look for new duties, said Koznishev, while, as we see, men, unfortunately, generally avoid theirs.
Duties are connected with rights, power, money, honours. That is what women are seeking, said Pestsov.
It is just as if I were to strive for the right of being a wet nurse and were offended because they pay women for it and won't pay me, said the old prince.
Turovtsin burst into loud laughter, and Koznishev felt sorry he had not made that remark himself. Even Karenin smiled.
Yes, but a man can't be a wet nurse, said Pestsov, while a woman...
Oh, yes, an Englishman on board ship did once nurse his baby, said the old prince, allowing himself this indelicacy in his daughter's presence.
There will be about as many women officials as there are of such Englishmen, said Koznishev.
Yes, but what is a girl to do if she has no home? Said Oblonsky, agreeing with Pestsov and supporting him, and thinking of the dancer, Chibisova, whom he had in his mind all the time.
If you looked carefully into that girl's story, you would find that she had left her family, or sister's family, where she might have done woman's work, said Dolly irritably, and unexpectedly intervening in the conversation. She probably guessed what girl her husband had in his mind.
But we are defending a principle, an ideal, said Pestsov in his sonorous bass. Women wish to have the right to be independent and educated. They are hampered and oppressed by the consciousness that this is impossible for them.
And I am hampered and oppressed by the knowledge that they won't take me as a wet nurse in the foundlings hospital, repeated the old prince, to the great joy of Turovtsin, who laughed till he dropped the thick end of a piece of asparagus into the sauce.
Chapter 11. Everybody took part in the general conversation except Kitty and Levin. At first, when the influence of one nation on another was being talked about, thoughts of what he had to say on the subject involuntarily came into Levin's mind. But these thoughts, formerly so important to him, now only flickered through his mind as in a dream and were not of the slightest interest. It even struck him as strange that they should care to talk about things that could make no difference to anyone. In the same way, what was being said about the rights and the education of women should have interested Kitty. How often she had thought about that question when she remembered her friend abroad and the irksome state of dependence in which Varenka lived. How often she had wondered what would be her own fate if she did not get married, and how many times she had argued about it with her sister. But now it did not interest her at all. She and Levin were carrying on their own separate conversation, and it was not even a conversation, but a kind of mystic intercourse, which every moment bound them closer and closer, and created in both a feeling of joyful fear before the unknown upon which they were entering. They began by Levin's telling Kitty, in answer to her question of how he could have seen her in the carriage in the summer, how he was going back from the hayfields along the high road and met her.
It was early in the morning. I expect you had only just woken up. Your mother was asleep in her corner. It was a lovely morning. I was going along and wondering who that could be in a four-horsed coach, a splendid team with bells. And for an instant... You appeared, and I saw you at the window, sitting like this, holding the strings of your cap with both hands and thinking very deeply about something, he said, and smiled.
How I wish I knew what you were thinking about. Something important?
Was I not very untidy? She thought. But seeing the rapturous smile which the recollection of these details evoked, she felt that the impression she had produced was a very pleasing one. She blushed and laughed joyously.
I really don't remember.
How pleasantly Turovtsin laughs, said Lievin, looking with pleasure at his moist eyes and shaking body.
Have you known him long? Asked Kitty.
Who does not know him?
I see you think he is a bad man.
Not bad, but a mere cipher.
He is not. Change your opinion quickly, said Kitty. I, too, did not think much of him, but he is a dear fellow and wonderfully kind-hearted. He has a heart of gold.
How did you manage to find out his heart?
He and I are great friends. I know him very well. Last winter, soon after you came to us, she said with a penitent and at the same time a trustful smile. Dolly's children all had scarlet fever, and he happened to call. And fancy, she went on in a whisper, he was so sorry for her that he stopped and helped her to nurse the children. Really, he stayed 3 weeks in the house and looked after the children like a nurse.
I'm telling Konstantin Dmitrich about Turovtsin and the scarlet fever, she said, leaning over toward her sister.
Yes? Oh, it was wonderful. He is splendid, said Dolly, looking toward Turovtsin, who felt that he was being talked about, and giving him a gentle smile.
Lievin looked at Turovtsin again and wondered how it was he had failed to realize what a charming man he was.
I am sorry. Very sorry. I shall never again think ill of anyone, he said, merrily, expressing what he sincerely felt at the moment.
Chapter 12. In the conversation which had been begun on the rights of women, there were raised some questions not freely to be discussed in the presence of ladies concerning the inequalities of marriage relations. Pestsov more than once during dinner time flew at these questions, but Koznishev and Oblonsky carefully diverted him from them. When they rose from table and the ladies had left the room, Pestsov did not follow them, but turned to Karenin and began to state the chief cause of inequality. The inequality between husband and wife, in his opinion, lay in the fact that the infidelity of a wife and that of a husband were unequally punished, both by law and by public opinion. Oblonsky hurriedly offered Karenin a cigar.
No, I don't smoke, quietly replied Karenin.
And, as if wishing to show that he was not afraid of the conversation, he turned with a cold smile to Pestsov.
I imagine that the cause of the prevailing opinion lies in the very nature of things, he said, and was about to go to the drawing-room, but Turovtsin quite unexpectedly addressed him.
"Have you heard about Priyachnikov?" said Turovtsin, animated by the champagne he had drunk and impatient to break his silence, which had long oppressed him. And with a kindly smile on his moist and rosy lips, he went on addressing himself chiefly to Karenin, the principal guest. "Vasya Priyachnikov, as I was told today, has fought a duel with Kvitsky and killed him."
As one always seems to knock a sore place, so that day Oblonsky felt that unfortunately the conversation kept striking Karenin's sore place. He again made an attempt to draw his brother-in-law away, but Karenin himself asked with interest,
"What did Priyachnikov fight about?"
"His wife. He behaved like a brick, challenged the other, and killed him."
"Oh," said Karenin indifferently, and raising his eyebrows he went to the drawing-room.
"I'm so glad you came," said Dolly, with a frightened smile, as she met him in the sitting-room through which he had to pass. "I must speak with you. Let us sit down here." Karenin, with the same look of indifference produced by his raised eyebrows, sat down beside her and feigned a smile.
"Yes," he said. "Especially as I wish to ask you to excuse me for having to go away at once. I am leaving Moscow tomorrow."
Dolly was firmly convinced of Anna's innocence, and felt herself growing pale and her lips trembling from anger with this cold, unfeeling man who so calmly intended to ruin her innocent friend. "Alexei Alexandrovich," she said, looking into his eyes with desperate determination, "I asked you about Anna, and you did not give me an answer. How is she?"
"I think she is well, Darya Alexandrovna," replied Karenin, without looking at her.
"Alexei Alexandrovich, forgive me, I have no right to... But I love Anna like a sister and respect her, and I beg, I implore you to tell me what has happened between you. What do you accuse her of?"
Alexei Alexandrovich winced, and almost closing his eyes, bowed his head. "I expect your husband has told you the reasons which make me consider it necessary to change my former relations with Anna Arkadyevna," he said, without looking in her eyes, discontentedly eyeing Shcherbatsky, who was passing through the sitting room.
I don't believe it. I cannot believe it," Dolly said, clasping her bony hands with an energetic movement. She rose quickly, put her hand on Karenin's sleeve, and said, "We shall be disturbed here. Come this way, please." Dolly's excitement affected Karenin. He rose and obediently followed her into the schoolroom. They sat down at the table, covered with leather cloth, all cut about with penknives.
"I don't believe it.
I don't," she uttered, trying to catch his eyes, which avoided hers.
"One can't disbelieve facts, Darya Alexandrovna," said he, emphasizing the word facts.
"But what has she done?" asked Darya Alexandrovna. "What is it she has done?"
"She has despised her duties and betrayed her husband. That is what she has done," he said.
"No, no, it can't be. No, for God's sake, you are mistaken," said Dolly, raising her hands to her temples and closing her eyes.
Karenin smiled coldly with his lips only, wishing to prove to her and to himself the firmness of his conviction. But this passionate defense, though it did not shake him, lacerated his wound. He began speaking with more animation. "It is difficult to make a mistake when a wife herself announces to her husband that 8 years of married life and a son have all been an error, and that she wants to begin life from the beginning again," he said, crossly, sniffing.
"Anna and vice? I cannot combine them. I cannot believe it."
"Darya Alexandrovna," he said, now looking straight at Dolly's kind, excited face and feeling his tongue involuntarily loosened, "I would give much for the possibility of doubting. While I was in doubt, it was hard, but not so hard as it is now. While I doubted, I had hope. But now there is no hope left, and all the same, I doubt everything. I doubt everything so much that I hate my son, and sometimes believe he is not my son. I am very unhappy." There was no need for him to say this. Dolly had understood it as soon as he looked her in the face. She felt sorry for him, and her faith in her friend's innocence was shaken.
"Oh, it is terrible, terrible. But can it be true that you have decided on a divorce?"
"I have decided to take the final step. There is nothing else for me to do."
"Nothing to do? Nothing to do?"
she muttered, with tears in her eyes.
"No, there is something else to do," she said.
"That is just what is so terrible in this kind of grief, that you can't do as in all other troubles, losses or deaths, just bear your cross. But here you must act," he said, as if guessing her thoughts. "You must come out of the degrading position in which you are placed. It is impossible to live three together."
"I understand. I understand very well," said Dolly, and her head dropped. She was silent, thinking of herself and her own sorrow, and then suddenly and energetically she raised her head and folded her hands as in prayer.
But wait. You are a Christian. Think of her. What will become of her if you throw her off?
I have thought, Darya Alexandrovna, and have thought deeply, said Karenin. His face flushed in blotches, and his dim eyes looked straight at her. Dolly now pitied him with all her heart. I did that very thing when she herself informed me of my shame. I let everything go on as before. I gave her a chance to turn over a new leaf, and I tried to save her. With what result? She disregarded my very easy demand that she should observe the proprieties, he went on, getting heated. One may save a person who does not wish to perish, but if a nature is so spoilt and depraved that it regards ruin as salvation, what can one do? Anything but divorce, answered Dolly. But what is anything?
No, this is too awful. She will be nobody's wife. She will be ruined.
What can I do? Said Karenin, shrugging his shoulders and raising his eyebrows. The recollection of his wife's last delinquency irritated him so much that he again became as cold as he had been at the beginning of the conversation. I am very grateful for your sympathy, but it is time for me to go, he said, rising.
No, wait a bit. You should not ruin her. Wait a bit. I will tell you about myself. I married, and my husband deceived me. In my anger and jealousy, I wished to abandon everything. I myself wished. But I was brought to my senses. And by whom? Anna saved me. And here I am living, my children growing, my husband returns to the family and feels his error, grows purer and better, and I live. I have forgiven, and you must forgive.
Karenin listened, but her words no longer affected him. All the bitterness of the day when he decided on a divorce rose again in his soul. He gave himself a shake and began to speak in a loud and piercing voice. I cannot forgive. I don't wish to and don't think it would be right. I have done everything for that woman, and she has trampled everything in the mud which is natural to her. I am not a cruel man. I have never hated anyone, but I hate her with the whole strength of my soul, and I cannot even forgive her because I hate her so much for all the wrong she has done me. He said with tears of anger, choking him.
Love those that hate you,
whispered Dolly, shamefacedly. Karenin smiled contemptuously. He had long known all that, but it could not apply to his case.
Love them that hate you, but you can't love them whom you hate. Forgive me for having upset you. Everyone has trouble enough of his own.
And having got himself under control, Karenin quietly rose, said goodbye, and went away. Chapter 13. When everybody was leaving the table, Levin wanted to follow Kitty into the drawing-room, but was afraid she would not like it because it would make his attentions to her too obvious. So he stopped with the group of men taking part in their conversation. But without looking through the open door at Kitty, he was conscious of her movements, her looks, and the place in the drawing-room where she sat. He began at once, and without the slightest effort, to fulfill the promise he had made her of thinking well of and always liking everybody. The conversation had turned to the question of village communes, in which Pestsov saw some special principle which he called the chorus principle. Levin did not agree either with Pestsov or with his brother Sergei, who, in a way of his own, both admitted and did not admit the importance of the Russian communal system. But he talked to them only with the idea of getting them to agree and softening their controversy. He was not at all interested in what he himself said, still less in what they were saying, and only desired one thing, that everybody should feel contented and pleased. He now knew the one thing that was important, and that one thing was at first there in the drawing-room, but afterwards began moving and paused in the doorway. Without looking round, he felt a pair of eyes and a smile directed toward him, and he could not help turning. She stood in the doorway with Shcherbatsky and was looking at him. "I thought you were going to the piano," he said, moving toward her. "That is what I miss in the country. Music." "No, we were only coming to call you away." "Thank you for coming," she said, rewarding him with a smile, as with a gift. "What is the use of arguing? No one ever convinces another."
"Yes, you're quite right," said Levin. "For the most part, people argue so warmly only because they cannot make out what it is that their opponent wants to prove."
Levin had often noticed in arguments among the most intelligent people that after expending enormous efforts and an immense number of logical subtleties and words, the disputants at last became conscious of the fact that the thing they had been at such pains to prove to one another had long ago, from the very beginning of the controversy, been known to them, but that they liked different things and were disinclined to mention what they liked lest it should be attacked. He had experienced the fact that sometimes, in the middle of a discussion, one understands what it is that one's opponent likes, and suddenly likes it oneself and immediately agrees with him, when all proofs become superfluous and unnecessary. Sometimes the reverse happens. One at last mentions the thing one likes, for the sake of which one has been devising arguments, and if this is said well and sincerely, one's opponent suddenly agrees and ceases to dispute. This was what he wanted to express. She wrinkled her forehead, trying to understand, but as soon as he began to explain, she understood. "I see. One must find out what one's opponent is contending for, what he likes, and then one can." She had completely grasped and found the right expression for his badly expressed thought. Levin smiled joyfully. He was so struck by the change from the confused, wordy dispute with his brother and Pestsov to this laconic, clear, and almost wordless communication of a very complex idea. Shcherbatsky left them, and Kitty went up to a table prepared for cards, sat down, took a piece of chalk, and began drawing concentric circles on the new green cloth of the table. They went back to the conversation at dinner about women's rights and occupations. Levin agreed with Dolly that a girl who does not get married can find woman's work in the family. He supported this view by saying that no family can dispense with a help, and that in every family, rich or poor, there are and must be nurses, either paid or belonging to the family. "No," said Kitty, blushing, but looking all the more boldly at him with her truthful eyes. "A girl may be so placed that she cannot enter into a family without humiliation, while she herself..." He understood the allusion. "Oh, yes," he said. "Yes, yes, yes, you're right, you're right." And he understood all that Pestsov at dinner had been trying to prove about the freedom of women, simply because he saw in Kitty's heart fear of the humiliation of being an old maid, and, loving her, he too felt that fear and humiliation, and at once gave up his contention. There was a pause. She still continued drawing on the table with the chalk. Her eyes shone.